A few years ago, my colleague, the Reverend Robin Bartlett, who grew up Unitarian Universalist, preached a sermon she called Children Will Listen. It was, you might guess, a reference to the song from the musical Into the Woods, as well as a reference to the subtle and not so subtle messages she received in the church and faith of her childhood. As she tells it, she grew up in UU in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s in a church where, as the old joke about us goes, the only time you heard the word Jesus was when the minister tripped on his way to the pulpit. I knew very well, she says, what words we weren't allowed to say from a very early age. God, Jesus, heaven, hell, sin, salvation, and Ronald Reagan. We were, she says, an Orthodox church. From these experiences, she describes how she learned to become an evangelical atheist UU child, earnestly believing that if you only believed believing that you only believed in God or Jesus if you were stupid, and if enough people knew there wasn't a God, the world would be a better place. Looking back as an adult, she realized, of course, that this reactive atheism that she had been taught was a result of the grown-ups in the church's religious upbringing, their injuries and struggles. But as a kid, she just received it as her inheritance. It was her religion. In her podcast, On Being, Krista Tippett begins every interview with the same question. She says, tell me about the spiritual or religious background of your childhood. Now, without fail, all of these elicit rich, visceral, juicy stories, stories that contain the seeds of what the people will become. Everyone from Yo-Yo Ma to Joanna Macy, to Jonathan Haidt, to Thich Nhat Hanh, you can hear in their answers to this question the seeds of these great people. Each time I hear this part of her interview, I think of Robin's sermon. And I think about my kids, and about all of our kids. The kids who are growing up here in our congregation and in the Unitarian Universalist faith. And I wonder, how will they answer this question someday? Whether they're asked by an interviewer or by their minister to light the chalice. What will they say are the gifts of wonder and meaning, ritual and song, or lack thereof that they received? What messages of worth or belonging, transformation, and hope? And often when I hear these interviews, I think of my own answers to these questions, the answers that so many of us might have, whether we were raised in a UU church or in another tradition or in no faith at all. I wonder at the ways that we as children were listening and how we as adults still remember. It is never a simple thing, after all, to piece together our stories, to fashion together something we might call wholeness, integrity, authenticity. The church of Robin's childhood, like many Unitarian Universalist congregations in the 70s, 80s, and much of the 90s, was a church shaped by its members' personal experience, as she realized later, of a certain kind of Christianity and a certain kind of religious injury too many of our members had personally felt. And in the ways they experienced this sort of Christianity that was playing out in the wider U.S. culture, in workplaces, in family lives, politics, schools, and You remember the so-called culture wars? We thought they were over. During this time, we became the anti-church church. And as some have said, rather than following our call to be countercultural, we decided our cause was to be counter-religious. All of this created an interesting paradox because when we form religious communities in reaction to other religious communities, that anti-church church, rather than, say, forming them in response to a positive, integrated vision of our own, these religious communities and the people in them and their children are in many ways still formed and shaped by that old past religious experience that we were trying to flee, just in the negative, shadowed versions of these religious traditions. They're empty outlines, they're ghosts. In the late 90s, a popular UUA curriculum emerged called the Haunting House that was meant to address the ways that these religious pasts would continue to influence us, and not just influence, of course, but haunt us. The word haunting conveys something scary, even terrifying, chilling, bone-shaking. Most importantly, being haunted has the effect of keeping us hidden, tentative, rigid, on guard, rule-bound. This is what Christine Robinson is describing when she talks about spiritual shame. Now, this past Tuesday, we hosted here in our sanctuary the director of religious education from one of our UU congregations in Salt Lake City, Liz Martin. She gave a great presentation and then answered every question that we all could throw at her about the Church of Latter-day Saints, which is the church where she was brought up and where she and her husband were married, sealed. And also the church she left 20 years ago for Unitarian Universalism. She told us about the experience of going to the temple to be sealed with her husband in marriage after looking forward to it her whole life. Now, instead of the spiritual elation that she was supposed to feel, Liz shared that she felt instead disappointment, confusion, disorientation. She said, to tell you the truth, I kind of just thought the whole thing was weird. Now, in these moments, there are two possible responses. Either we decide there's something wrong with us, or there's something wrong with the religion that we're trying to practice. And when people tell me these sorts of stories, when many of you have shared with me these sorts of stories, usually you say, I picked the latter. How wrong, obviously dumb, how stupid the ideas of that religion were, how people believing in God or Jesus are just stupid, right? But then we keep talking and keep remembering the experience as it actually played out. We go back to that original experience, and usually you remember before there was the latter, there was the former. First, you decided there was something wrong with you. That's what Liz shared that she felt when she didn't get the temple. Rather than doubting the church, she doubted herself. Her beliefs weren't strong enough, her spirit not pure enough, her dedication not deep enough. So she studied more, served more, tried harder. A few years later, however, she decided it wasn't meant to be, and she left the LDS church. Many of us who grew up in and then left other religious traditions can relate with this experience. Maybe it wasn't even about beliefs per se. Maybe it was literally about who we are, our sexual orientation, our gender. Maybe it was an experience of abuse from someone we trusted in a religious community. Walking away from these religious communities and traditions can take years, yet happen as if in an instant. When we leave, Many of us also leave our primary friendship circle, our families of origin, and something that has been at the center of our identity, our sense of who we are, our people, our sense of belonging, our hymns. No wonder it can feel like we are haunted. It is a huge and complicated loss. Today, Unitarian Universalism remains a place where many people who have left another religious tradition can find sanctuary and a liberating spiritual freedom. Now, just as a small sample, I wonder if we can just do a quick survey of those of you here today. If you're willing, I'm going to invite you to raise your hands, and you're going to pick one of three categories. First, if your upbringing had you connected to one or more religious traditions other than Unitarian Universalism, will you raise your hand? Okay, keep raising, and then now look around. Okay. And then if you were like Sally, starting at childhood or youth, raised in this or another Unitarian Universalist or Unitarian or Universalist congregation, will you raise your hand? That's good. And finally, if you were raised outside of a formal religious tradition, no church, no synagogue, no mosque, any of those. Yeah, I know. Some of you kind of raised your hand halfway in all three, right? That's great. I think it was completely eyeballing it, but I think we were pretty close to that 4 out of 5, at least the large majority. That last group, however, I want to just say a few words on it. That last group, you might know, is growing, especially with those who are under age 30 or 35 or so. And not just here in our congregation or in Unitarian Universalism, but just nationally, many more than in prior generations have not been raised or affiliated with any religious tradition or community. Many of these had those parents who left the religious tradition and never returned, and so didn't raise their kids connected to a church. Now, if you're in this group, you might wonder, for example, if pledging is something you do with a sorority or a fraternity. Or you might call your minister for every single thing, God bless you. Or never at all. Your reaction to the word prayer, for example, may not be reactive negativity, but more nervous curiosity, wondering if it could be something you could learn. Would you seem silly if you asked how to do it, why, or when? And most of all, you wonder if there are words you could learn, rituals you could practice, songs you could sing, anything that would express that feeling you have sometimes. When you look at the stars on a clear night and feel connected to them somehow, and yet so aware of how small you are, how small the moment is, what a blip in time your life represents, and still somehow knowing that your life also matters, that feeling you have when you know your breath in and out is connected to everything else, your great sense that if you tug on any piece of this vast universe, it will reveal itself as connected to every other thing, you wonder. You hope that this place, this faith, this religious community will help you stay connected to this feeling. By the way, in case you're wondering, all three categories struggle and wonder about all of these things too. All three categories struggle to piece together a sense of wholeness and integrity when it comes to their religious and spiritual upbringing, as well as its present and their future. All three categories struggle to claim with clarity and purpose who their people are, what words and rites will fit, and to reference Rumi, which of the thousand ways there are to kneel and kiss the ground will connect with that deeply felt sense of truth and beauty. All of us struggle to believe that whatever the way we have within us could be good enough, that we are good enough, just as we are, loved and worthy, just as we are. All of us struggle to not just do this with shadow, but with light, not in reaction to ghosts of the past, but in reverence to all that is tangibly alive. A few years ago, I asked Christine about her ideas on this question of spiritual shame. I was curious if she'd done any work in her congregation to try to address people's shame about their religious past. She sighed and she said she'd tried, but her folks repeatedly said they had no such thing. "We're not ashamed," they said, "we're fine." Shame, it's not an easy thing to claim. And especially after a while, the brain plays tricks, employs these coping techniques so that we don't remember that we, like Liz, first blamed ourselves. The pain and shame of those early experiences instead creates a wall between ourselves and the whole of that old religious tradition, a wall we decide marks off all that is wrong from all that is right, the old world that was bad and wrong from the new world that's good and right and true. Guarding that wall becomes a practice of scorn, resentment, and shame turned outward. As Christine says, if there's one thing a person who has been shamed knows how to do, it is to shame others in return. It reminds me of that saying that I often quote to you from Richard Rohr, that pain that is not transformed is transmitted. You just can't say it enough. Pain that is not transformed is transmitted. Because the walls, the scorn, the haunting, it is about pain. Pain that hasn't been properly addressed, fully healed, or integrated into a new story of spirituality. Healing this pain or giving up the ghost of our religious past begins simply by openly and non-defensively remembering those pasts. Because walls don't work, whether we're talking about national borders or spiritual paths. Though we may have hoped to leave it all behind, deep in our hearts and in our bodies reside the remnants of our spiritual and religious pasts, the stories and rituals we shared or longed to share, the songs we sang, the people we gathered with, the ways they loved us or failed to. Healing begins when we realize how much this past still pulls on us, even if it is just in our avoidance, especially when we are grieving, confused, afraid, or alone, seeking an anchor in an open sea. Healing begins first by remembering it all we felt, even when it was painful. All those places of shame, the feelings of being unworthy or deficient. And from there, healing continues. As Christine says, when we realize in those places that our ways of being and believing, even if they didn't fit with what others may have wanted, even if it didn't seem like we got it, even if it wasn't how we were supposed to feel or believe or be, none of this actually made us broken or wrong or less important or made us less worthy of the experience or the tradition or our right to call ourselves apart. A number of years ago, I was serving as a chaplain in a community hospital when I was called to help a large Catholic family. And if you don't know, I was raised, my religious upbringing was Catholic. So I walked in the room to find them all wearing rosaries around their necks, which is not okay. Just so you know. As I arrived and identified myself, they asked if I could find holy water and bless one of their stuffed animals for their family member who was ill, which is also not okay. But I did it. So we circled around the matriarch's bedside. I had pulled out the holy water and was blessing everyone with it. Among the circle, I spotted a lesbian couple, just fully integrated. We prayed the Lord's Prayer, often with not the right words, and it was all perfect. And suddenly, right there amongst them, I realized there was nothing the Pope or anyone else, any priest out there, nothing anyone could do to control who calls themselves a Catholic. Or what Catholics actually believe, or how they engage with their tradition. Even in Catholicism, you can't stop people from making their own way, finding their own ways to kneel and kiss the ground, to proclaim and experience truth. Which also meant that the pieces of Catholicism that were still a part of me and that fed me rather than haunted me could stay, could be reclaimed, could be integrated and celebrated. It didn't need to be an either or. Our spiritual paths, I realize, need not be a process of serial monogamy. It's good, right? Right? It need not be a process where you are seriously committed to a series of religious or spiritual traditions, but only one at a time. And wholly rejecting one as you commit to another. Instead, it could be a process of repetition and revision, or of relentless accumulation that paradoxically results in a continuous stripping away, all that you might reveal something true and raw and real that was there all along. Whether intentionally or not, we were listening as children and we absorbed. And as adults, we remember. Nothing we could do would allow us to give up our past, religious or otherwise. Not entirely. But we can give up the ghosts in favor of the gifts. Give up the off-limits words in favor of renewed and deeper meaning. The shadow in favor of the light, the wall of scorn in favor of the great, whole, and holy story still and always growing. In our walk together, we can be not just a sanctuary from past injuries, but a place for healing and transformation. We can hold one another and bear witness as we retell and rebuild our stories. Creating and claiming a positive faith, a constructive theology, and a spirituality truly open to all the sources of truth, beauty, and love for our children, for ourselves, for our church, and for our world. Let us keep listening and continue our walk together. May it be so. And amen.